So I'm going to talk a little bit about magnetic draping over moving objects, basically, bubbles or cores or whatever, in the context of galaxy clusters. Galaxy clusters contain supernova. I was going to try harder, but it just wasn't worth it. So this is kind of this is one of our simulation results, and this is kind of the cartoon I'll use to sort of talk about what I mean. So magnetic draping, in this case, you know, just what its name implies. You have some moving, in this case, a dense sort of bullet in a, through the intercluster medium of a galaxy cluster. And it's moving through some external magnetized medium. And it's going to just start sweeping up this magnetic field. And it's going to start collecting. What we're looking at is a plot, an isodensity of isodensity contour, and a plot of magnetic energy density. And
experimenting lights.
That's all right. So we're looking at magnetic energy density. You know, that's light blue is the ambient stuff. And as it sweeps through, it builds up in the layer around the core. We see magnetic field lines building up, particularly along the stagnation line, becoming extremely dense magnetic field lines, so high magnetic energy density. Off-axis, you can see the magnetic field lines can, you know, slide around the object. They're still, you know, the field is still enhanced here, but not as much along the stagnation line. And so this is the basic picture about what I'll be talking about, and this is basically all the physics there is. So the talk's essentially over. Pardon? That's just a rendering of the thing which is moving through. In this case, it's a contour of constant density of this dense thing that's plowing through the ambient medium. So this is a simulation result, and that, you know, people can always ask numerical questions, the role of simulation in science. But I think we can all agree that any simulation result rendered this prettily is clearly true. So this idea of magnetic draping isn't a new one, and it's actually comes up again and again in space sciences, particular sort of solar system stuff. It's been around for decades. There's some nice examples. This is a more recent example of magnetic draping around Earth as it just plows through the solar wind and sweeps up magnetic field lines. This is kind of an acute little result. The reason the Earth's poles flip is sort of a catastrophic failure of the dynamo inside the Earth. So there's a brief period of time where the Earth has no magnetic field. So you might worry that now the Earth is just going to be completely zapped by cosmic rays and everything's going to die. And this is actually a very cute little result. This enough magnetic field builds up in here that it can actually induce a magnetic field even in an initially neutral ionosphere, which isn't an ionosphere if it's neutral, but unmagnetized, unionized ionosphere. It can induce a strong enough magnetic field that it would actually protect from a certain amount of cosmic rays. So even these field reversals aren't necessarily catastrophic to life. Yeah?
Do you see that happening in Venus, which has no magnetic field?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. The little cartoon I showed before has no... This thing is completely unmagnetized. If this thing did have a magnetic field, what it would basically do is just push this contact, this magnetic contact discontinuity, out further away from the actual density contact. But it's exactly the same thing. There's very little physics in here. It's almost just kinematics. You're just pushing through a vector field. And
Earth's magnetic field is decreasing now, right?
I think that's right. There you go. And this is why my research should continue to be funded. That's right. Yeah, so this actually happens in six... Thank you, actually, for asking this. This happens really quickly, right? In almost no time, you sweep... it almost doesn't matter how weak the magnetic field is, because in almost any of these cases, you're traveling, you know, wildly supralphanically. So in almost no time, you sweep up a significant, or a dynamically significant magnetic field, depending on the dynamics. So this is 600 seconds. You know, Earth's magnetic field turns off. 600 seconds later, there's enough magnetic field around to, you know, this is sort of surprising. Yeah, I mean, now that's going to be a really awkward 10 minutes, admittedly, but. So, you know, same thing happens around other solar system things. Doesn't have to be around the sun. This is Titan around Saturn. And the these plots were making the argument that this draping around Titan would actually be observable with Cassini. I don't know how this turned out. I don't know if in the end that Cassini saw this or not. And comets are another example, you know, plowing through the interplanetary field. And this is kind of a neat plot because it shows that the resulting distortions, this is velocity, this is magnetic field, the resulting distortions are, you know, actually remain for, you know, distances, you know, much, much larger than the distance of the actual obstruction here. And so, you know, in principle, you can see the wake, the magnetic wake left by comets, which is, again, you know, moderately cool. So this has been around for a while. And in the space science, mainly you're interested in this draped magnetic field as sort of a tracer. Maybe you can see the wake of the comet. Maybe you can observe the interaction of Titan's magnetic field with Saturn through radiation around this draped field. But the magnetic field itself, generally, except for that case of the Earth, isn't all that interesting in these cases. But what's more interesting is if you take this idea and apply it to something like galaxy clusters. So here we're taking a look at Perseus A. You know, these very, everyone in this room has probably seen this picture 10,000 times, these big radio bubbles in X-ray. Can't really see it from this image, but these bubble edges are remarkably sharp, considering that thermal diffusion, you know, if this is just hot gas, you'd completely wipe these things out in 10 to the 8 years. So, you know, is it possible perhaps that the bubble's motion just through the ICM magnetic field was enough to build up a magnetic layer to sort of insulate against the thermal conduction, because of course you can't transport against the magnetic field. The other issue is of mergers of galaxy clusters. This is a picture of a merger of a galaxy into a larger core, which actually isn't what the text is about, but I'm not going to lie to you. This is just a cool picture, so I just put it up. But, you know, again, you have minor mergers, you know, the stuff falling into some big core. The little core's gas can be swept away. And how far in this core can get in the minor merger to the big core before completely losing its identity actually matters a bit if you're interested in, say, enrichment profiles or population profiles. How far can this thing get in before it's completely been stripped away or sort of blended in with the cluster? So again, if a magnetic field can sort of cocoon this thing as it goes in, it's going to matter. That's going to tell you where this thing will finally get before it gets disrupted. So there's been a little work about using this sort of picture in galaxy clusters. There's some analytic work, rigorous but therefore necessarily fairly simple, by Ludakov, Maxim Ludakov, Purdue, 2004-ish, mainly focusing, you know, on the stuff you can do, getting the stagnation line profile right. So just right along the axis of this thing that's moving in. And you can get field strength. So if you assume a perfectly spherical, rigid object moving through a potential flow, and the magnetic field gets ramped up just kinematically, there's no real magnetic field dynamics in here, you get this profile for the magnetic field strength. This is the radius of the sphere, this is the distance, and you get an expression for the thickness of the resulting thickness of the magnetic field layer, which goes as 1 over the Galfanic Mach number. So you can say rigorous things, but fairly simple things. On the other extreme, there's been work by one group led by Asai, that did, you know, really did lots and lots of fairly complex simulations, sort of taking the kitchen sink approach, where everything imaginable was put into these simulations. And the reason is they wanted to ask one very specific question. Can, under these very realistic situations, can the magnetic field build up enough to prevent thermal conduction? So the answer, it turns out, is yes. This is a pretty picture from one of their papers. The answer is yes, but in this kitchen sink approach, it's a little difficult to actually, you know, untangle what's going on. So our approach, basically, was to try to get a little deeper using both analytics and 3D simulations to really understand the process of this draping. And you know, really get into the problem, which you should be able to, right? Because it's a real, there's not a lot of physics going on here. You should be able to really understand it and then see and apply it to different contexts. So we did 3D AMR simulations in a context, you know, semi-relevant to galaxy clusters. Did extended the analytic work that's been done quite a ways, and did a linear theory analysis to try to see if this thin layer actually does anything interesting. It's easy to stop conduction, right? It doesn't take much magnetic field, in, say, in galaxy clusters. It doesn't take much field at all to prevent you from transporting heat in any interesting amount across the field. But are there other dynamical effects? So this is just the little cartoon of the sort of numerical experiments we were doing. Dense core, velocity field, fired upwards, magnetic field sort of turns on. So there's no transient of starting it up in a magnetic field. So this thing falls, well, moves into the magnetized region and starts sweeping up stuff. Ever since first setting up this simulation, I've regretted my choice of direction, because everybody now, and I do it too, everyone now calls this a bubble. Especially those rendered things, it's a bubble going up. It's not, it's just a heavy thing fired into gas. I should have fired it sideways or something. And of course, I could flip all the figures, but anyway. So we did these simulations using the flash code, mainly because AMR, I mean, these sorts of problems are like the poster child for why, you know, why AMR can often be useful. Because the interesting stuff is happening in a thin layer. And so with AMR, you can just put tons of resolution there, and you know, you don't care about, you can have it go in a box a million miles long, and it doesn't matter because you're not resolving anything up there. So it's very handy. There are codes out there with much more sophisticated treatments of magnetic fields. But, and so, you know, that would matter if we were calculating structure functions of the magnetic turbulence left in the wake or something. But we're not. We don't care right now. Right now, we're just focusing on the dynamics of the magnetic layer, which is very simple. So we don't need 12th-order finite difference Runge-Kutta, you know, thing to do the MHD. So AMR is especially useful in 3D because there's computational cost is higher in 3D. And doing this simulation in 3D is actually really important, because sometimes 2D just isn't enough. This is an example of what happens in 2D. I'm going to play this movie again, this time with scientifically added audio. So, and what happens here is actually, in some sense, completely predictable, right? In 2D, the field lines can't slip around. There's nothing that can happen except the magnetic field strength building up arbitrarily strong ahead of this thing. Actually, not only slingshotting this thing down, but actually compressing this core, which is much, much more massive than anything in the environment, squishing it, then flinging it down. And what's funny is this has actually been foreshadowed in the early literature. People have done things like 2D simulations, and they've just noticed that magnetic energy density grows more strongly in the 2D simulations. And of course, this is a problem with this sort of kitchen sink approach. There's so much physics in these simulations, they couldn't run it long enough to notice that there was no sort of steady state. So there remain, even though this is a simple problem, there are fundamental things poorly understood about this process. Yeah?
These simulations, are the way of
free to escape from their...
Yeah, there's magnetic outflow boundary conditions on the side. But if you're going superalphanically enough, then the magnetic energy density builds up faster than it can be transported away through the side. So you still get this slingshot effect.
So if leaking of energy is negligible, then it should be symmetric, right?
Yeah. Well, except for the fact that the way I set it up, if I think that would be true if I set it up in a magnetic field, if it was already in the magnetic field and fired it up, then it would bounce back and forth forever, and the only asymmetry would come from just numerical dissipation. I started out, remember, outside of a magnetic field, so there's no flux lines behind it to fire it back. Right? Does that...
Isn't it like throwing something against an elastic?
And
the velocity at the end would be exactly the same.
Yeah, okay, I agree. I thought, yes. No, you're right. This highly informative simulation, this is just, I'm only showing one part of the domain and one part of the time evolution. It's not going to be completely symmetric because there's a turbulent wake that forms behind this as it goes on, and now you're compressing the turbulent wake and the sort of stuff behind it. But yeah, if I ran it long enough, but I didn't think that was sufficiently useful exercise to follow the simulation that much longer.
Did you assume for the magnetic field the initial one, which was around, it stretch infinitely far?
Yeah. So it's just a uniform field, in this case, pointing in the x direction, constant strength except for this little tanh profile as it goes through. So this is, of course, wildly unrealistic in the cluster environment. In the cluster environment, there's a very interesting question about what is the largest characteristic length scale of the magnetic field. And there's some hope that actually you could, we're hoping that that's the sort of thing that this could, once we understand this, you could start asking that more detailed question. But for now, right now, this is the simplest possible thing. The next thing is like a turbulent magnetic field, or at least a simple magnetic field with a characteristic scale to see. But even a magnetic field with a fairly small characteristic scale, this stretching will tend to make the magnetic field coherent on fairly significant length scales. But presumably there's some scale on which that's so small that won't matter. And then you'll get reconnection and stuff, and then this won't matter. But exactly where that scale isn't clear.
There must be something to hold the magnetic field, which was there already, and maybe it's a big cluster which holds the field.
Yeah, so...
And you bounce the thing back.
Yeah.
Did you mention the Mach number?
So these are all subsonic, Mach number kind of a quarter-ish, and highly superalphanic Mach number square root 400-ish. 20-ish. So the question of what happens when this is supersonic is an interesting one, and one which we're just starting to explore. If it's supersonic enough that the bow shock is well separated from this sort of magnetic bow wave, then the basic picture doesn't change all that much, although the details do, because now instead of a uniform velocity field here, there's some curvature to the velocity field, so that actually modifies here. If it's just barely supersonic, and the shock wave, the bow shock is actually interfering with the, or overlaps with this this magnetic bow wave, this magnetic drape, then of course everything's much more complicated. All right, so it's sort of remarkable that you can understand a lot from here by taking a look at potential flow around solid spheres. It isn't It isn't obvious to me that that this should be the case, but it turns out to be true. This actually isn't the best plot for showing this, because the color scales aren't the same. But other than the fact that the magnetic field eventually becomes strong enough to have a back reaction and starts peeling off, first pushes this up a little bit and then starts peeling it off, the leading edge of this actually is very well described by the potential flow solution. And this is actually shown here sort of poorly. This is magnetic field strength along the stagnation line. And if you treat this as a sphere with a radius, just the curvate radius of curvature at this working surface here, you get dead on the analytic results from the pressure from the potential flow simulations, and you can then not quite self-consistently, but you can kinematically evolve the magnetic field in this potential flow simulation, and just calculate where the magnetic field is going to start to become important enough to modify the flow, and you can get this angle, which then is the opening angle of this part of the this part of the drape, which is sort of interesting. This is basically also the point where vorticity generation becomes maximum, which is actually why the liftoff occurs there. And you can take a look at the different terms in the vorticity equation and understand where this is coming from. And then, of course, you get really cool turbulent wakes. So we've done a bunch of these simulations. These are three simulations varying just the speed of the core, and that's worth just sort of doing this. You can see fairly obvious things, like the faster this core is moving, first the more distorted out here the field is, and this sort of wake closes up because you're going up even faster compared to the Alphane speed than in the other case. And you can take a look at cut planes of these three simulations, and probably not quite obvious from here, but the where this starts peeling off depends on the speed. And also here, this is so slow, you get some vortices that have end up separating a little bit, but you get this very characteristic sort of head and shoulders shape. There's this head, and the peeling off is dominated by vorticity. At long distances away, you should get this angle should have something to do with the ratio of the velocities, Alphane velocity to speed. But it's modified a little. It's modified by vortices, which are shed by the head. And this is sort of, if you like comparing things by eye, this is sort of suggestive, because if you take a look at pulsar winds seen in radio and X-ray, this sort of head and shoulders shape appears in a lot of different contexts. And usually when this is modeled, people talk about the pulsar wind interacting with some density gradient, which just happens to be there. And apparently a whole bunch of these pulsars just happen to be going through density gradients. These things happen, but this would provide a very nice explanation for this. Right? Again, it's a little more complicated, because obviously the pulsar wind, the pulsar isn't some solid object going through magnetic field. The wind is interacting with the ICM2, or IGM2, but sort of cute. So finally, does it matter? This thin magnetic layer builds up. Does it have any interesting effects? Well, you can sort of answer this just in linear theory, just taking a look at three layers, unmagnetized, unmagnetized, magnetized, having gravity and shear, and seeing what this does to the Rayleigh-Taylor instability or the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And there's stable regions for these two instabilities. And it turns out that if the Alphane velocity is of order a few times the relevant velocity, whether that's G over K, squared G over K, or U, the shear velocity, it just happens to be a few times this. This is that quantity squared. So this is just a factor of two. You can get this layer stabilizing things even on wavelengths like an order of magnitude longer than the thickness of the layer, which isn't, at least wasn't to me, at all obvious. Yeah?
Yeah,
Can you show again the setup for?
Yeah, sure. I can show it. I don't know if you can see it. Top layer, magnetized layer, bottom layer, the form of the perturbations, which doesn't matter. It's assumed that this has the same properties as this. So this is shearing in the same direction as this. This is shearing the other way. It's the same, these two densities. Yeah, gravity's down. But you know, it doesn't matter. You can do gravity both ways. And it's actually sort of surprising what happens. So, of course, analytics aren't ever true unless computations prove them. So, you know, you can do lots of cute little, this is Kelvin Helmholtz with the layer being given a god-awful big kick initially. And if, you know, if the Alphane speed's a little bigger than the shear speed, this thing flattens right out, even though this is, you know, 10 times or so the thickness of this layer. And if it's below that, it gets completely disrupted. And, you know, you can do theory versus simulation, and they agree very well. So presumably that means I, or truth be told, Mathematica didn't mess up the linear theory analysis. So basically, that's kind of it. Even thin layers can have interesting effects, and these thin, strong layers are built up automatically, almost instantly, as soon as you start plowing through the ICM. And you know, it's sort of amazing that there are still these extremely simple hydrodynamic problems you can still, that you can do interesting things with linear theory and with very simple numerical experiments.
Without magnetic fields, if you have radical Helmholtz, then you are ruled by the Richardson
number. Okay? Yes. So I'm just because I'm just yes. I think
that. So the presence of the magnetic layer modifies this Richardson criterion.
Well, you'd have to have you'd end up with a new criterion, right? You'd have the Richardson criterion absent the magnetic field, but now there's this extra stabilizing effect, which would then have to be compared to. I mean, the new criterion just has something to do with the Alphanic velocities and the relevant velocities. Just you can express the Richardson criterion that way too.
Acts like a kind of surface tension.
Yeah. Well, it acts almost exactly like a surface tension. I'm sure. I think the most important effects of this could be just treated exactly as a surface tension. Well, not very close. Yeah.
Another setting where there are objects that are dense objects moving through something that may be a magnetic medium are supernova remnants, where there's pieces of shrapnel, as we
okay, sure.
call them, right. seen in some cases like Hubble. And there's a story about them, of course, of supersonic shock heating. You can see them in the X-ray emission, but it might turn out that, but I'm sure all of that is ignored. And it might turn out that there's some interesting piece of the story that might be connected to what you're doing.
I mean, it might be a way of. But thank you for working so hard to bring this back to supernova. It might be a way of sort of protecting the shrapnel.
It lasts a long time, and I'm not quite sure, but my recollection is that that's a little surprising given the conductivity you might expect.
Well, so if you do have high density contrast, it does take a long time for Kelvin Helmholtz or something to disrupt, because you know you kind of have to go past roughly as much mass as you have to get kind of order one entrainment and disruption. So if the density contrast is high enough, that takes a long time for it to happen. So for instance, if you take a look at these, you know, lovely pictures, if I run this without a magnetic field, this happens so quickly that these cores haven't had enough time to get disrupted. I would have to run this a very long time for that to happen. So there's already a fairly good lifetime, but you can estimate that, and, you know, Vail is old, and it shouldn't take that long to keep it, you know, to tear it apart. Whereas with this, you can suppress, like I said, an order of magnitude-ish wavelengths, and so you can. Anyway, that ends up probably being, for reasonable Fanuc Mach numbers, that just ends up being a significant fraction of the size of your object. So you can, you know, completely turn off those instabilities almost.
Make the connection with Super LP even more explicit. If I'm correct, when you start a explosion in the white dwarf for supernova 1A, mm-hmm. you also get this bubble
right.
that moves outwards.
So the difference
doesn't make any difference if that has to move through a magnetic field.
The difference there. Well, so it depends, I guess. So for this to happen, you have to move significantly superalphanically, which I guess would happen. Would happen in this case. There, the interaction of magnetic fields and flames is really interesting, and one which really hasn't been explored very much. I guess Frank's not here right now, but of course, the same reason that the magnetic field is interesting for the in its bubbles and galaxy clusters cases because it suppresses thermal conduction across. So what would that would do in the case of a flame bubble isn't at all clear, because the even in this very dense plasma, which is a very different case than this galaxy cluster, so things are very dense, but it's not. The thermal conductivity isn't primarily collisional. It's this degenerate electron, and that just gets turned off by a strong magnetic field. And even if conductivity along a field has you know in this very dense environment has very real features, as you can fill up Landau levels and you can get weird spikes in conductivity. So that I think. You know, there are white dwarfs with significant magnetic fields, and you know they might be the ones that become supernovas. And so there's lots of very interesting magnetic field flame, directly modifying the flame, that I don't think has been explored. Whether that, how that would play out in this bubble, I think is a little too complicated for me to guess at immediately. If this magnetic layer was sufficiently separated from the flame. Then I think you'd be fine, because you could be burning into, you know, relatively still random magnetization, and the coherent level could be pushed out. But if the field is now in the flame structure itself, then I don't know what happens, and I don't think anyone else does.
I missed why the magnetic instability was written, because you have a high entropy.
Oh well, so it's in the pictures I've shown, like the core moving through, that the Rayleigh-Taylor isn't going to be very relevant. If the core was somehow frozen in mid cluster, it might be. In the bubbles, these bubbles that would be more important. If the bubbles. Right. If the bubbles if the bubbles in the phase where it's actually rising. Then the rising motion it dominates, and you don't get Rayleigh-Taylor. The rising motion you can think of as one big Rayleigh-Taylor thing. But if the bubble's kind of inflating, and if it's been staying in one place, then Rayleigh-Taylor can start happening at the head of the bubble. But you have the linear theories thing. You can just do Rayleigh-Taylor and Kelvin-Helmholtz and anything you want. So, but for the picture that I'm showing here, certainly for the merging core, you wouldn't expect Rayleigh-Taylor to be important.
If there are no more questions, I'll questions, let's thank our speaker again.
You're going to take a 5-minute break?